Hello friends, Sam Jackson Reed, Digital Communications Coordinator and producer of the CSW Free to Believe Spotlight Series podcast here. Jumping in at the top of the episode to say thank you once again for joining us and to remind you that this is episode 5 in our Sudan Spotlight Series. So if you haven't listened to the previous episodes, jump on back to episode 1. Each episode builds upon the next. And so the information in this episode may not make quite as much sense outside of the context of the previous one. So please do jump back in and join us once you've listened to those. The other thing is we want to invite you to send us your questions. Maybe something throughout these series has sparked your interest, formed up a question that we haven't yet answered in this series so far. Please do send us a message. You can do that on our social media, on Facebook and on Instagram. The links to those are in the description box below. And we will gather up all those questions and put them to our expert team in a future question and response episode down the line. And finally, we just want to give you a heads up and make you aware that this episode features the topic of sexual violence quite heavily, as it is a feature, unfortunately, of the conflict in Sudan. So please be aware of that going in and aware of your surroundings as you listen to this episode. But thank you for listening, and I'll hand over to Darren and Kiri.
Welcome to CSW's Free to Believe Spotlight Series, where we take a deep dive into religious freedom issues across the globe. I'm Darren Edwell-Palker, pastor and president of CSW USA.
And I'm Kiri Kankwende, CSW's Press and Public Affairs Team Leader. In this series, we focus on one nation, exploring its challenges, telling the human stories at its heart, and uncovering its history as we work towards a world where everyone is free to believe. This week, we're joined by Dr. Katasa Gondwe, an expert on religious freedom and human rights in Africa and the Middle East. She has conducted extensive field research across both continents, testified at the US Congress, and spoken at the UN Human Rights Council. She is also CSW's Joint Director of Advocacy and Team Leader for Africa and the Middle East.
We also have Sarah joining us again, CSW's Sudan officer, with over a decade's experience working on human rights issues in Africa and specializing in freedom of religion or belief in Sudan. In order to carry out her work safely, she's using a pseudonym. So Sarah, Dr. Katasa, thank you so much for joining us today. Would you mind just updating us where we've been in our last few conversations on the history and the situation of what's taking place in the Sudan today?
Thank you so much, Darren. And it's great to be with you and Kiri here talking about Sudan again. Over the last few series, we've explored the current conflict in Sudan that started in April 2023. And talked about the main players, the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces, and the Sudan's National Army, the SAF, and how this conflict has been described as a war against civilians. And we've explored how Sudan is currently one of the largest humanitarian crises in the world, and the impact that the war has had on those who, civilians who are in the country, those who have had to flee the country. We've also heard about the experiences of different groups, Christians, those who are still experiencing religious freedom violations in the country, those who've experienced difficulties as they have sought safety and refuge outside the country. And we've really centered in on the tragedy of the conflict in Sudan, of how Sudan has been described in parts as the breadbasket. Some of the states where famine is now present have been places that have provided refuge, that have provided resources to the country. And we've heard from amazing Sudanese nationals talking about the devastating impact that the war's had on their own families, their friends, but also they've been able to share some of their hopes for what they would like to see their country become again.
Thank you, Sarah. So today we're moving further into those discussions, and we're going to focus particularly on the experience of women in Sudan, and particular their experiences both during the war and before. So, to begin with, When reporting back to the UN in Geneva, one of the members of the fact-finding mission described the fact-finding mission to Sudan described the situation for women in Sudan as shameful, and used the phrase, "The war is being fought on the bodies of women." She also noted that thousands of cases of sexual violence were being reported by health providers, but victims face stigma coming forward. There's obviously a lot in there. Dr. Kataza, can you expand on that a bit for us?
Yes. Sadly, this is a historical thing in the Sudanese conflict. But starting with the current one, it has indeed been described in those terms and is pretty accurate. There had been mass, a mass atrocity, actually, of sexual and gender-based violence, targeting women, targeting girls, targeting children, targeting elderly women, and even targeting men. And it started off with the Janjaweed, or now be styled into the RSF, attacking women in Khartoum. And the women who were initially targeted were refugees and asylum seekers who had sought refuge in Sudan from terror in their own countries, such as Eritrean ladies and Ethiopian women. They were the initial targets, but soon it began to target every woman, including the Sudanese women and girls and children. And it doesn't matter what class they are. In parts of Sudan, it is very race-based, but there's just been an outrageous amount of this kind of violence going on. The brutality has been unspeakable. And as I said, the RSF in particular, but the government itself also, the recognized government, should I say, the internationally recognized government, which is the Sudanese armed forces, have also done their fair bit of this. So bad is it that in Gezira state, women actually committed suicide walking into rivers rather than face the RSF when they heard they were coming. So as I said earlier, this has been an age-long tactic employed particularly by the RSF. If we go back to the previous real civil war in Sudan, which ended in 2005 with the creation of South Sudan and Northern Sudan, the Janjaweed were created by the military to attack the South. And these Janjaweed militias would brutalize Southern women. And so extensive was the rape there that women would say, well, at least I wasn't raped by the Janjaweed, if they were raped by their own members of their own army. So that kind of sexual violence has been a staple in every conflict in Sudan. We go on from there, and the same Janjaweed start to attack African tribes in Darfur. And that is where the situation got much more international recognition. And then these same Janjaweed are the RSF who have been brutalizing women in Sudan, which was previously Northern Sudan, during this current conflict. And it really is quite tragic that this is going on and has just continuing with nothing to stop these people from doing this. The women themselves are not getting the medical assistance they require, not just because of stigma, because the stigma still exists, but also because of the humanitarian situation where the kind of assistance they need is not within the country and needs to be brought in. So it's really quite tragic what is happening with these ladies.
As Dr. Kataza has said, this conflict-related sexual violence or sexual violence being in the context of war in Sudan, there are a number of female or women's-led organizations who say that when they see an uptick in sexual violence, they know that conflict is coming, things are going to get worse. It's often the women and girls who in Darfur who are attacked first. And many have reported that this has been ongoing, continuing in Darfur, even in so-called peace times, and that within a day of the conflict starting in April 2023, on the 15th of April 2023, reports of sexual violence were coming through to women's organizations, to doctors, to hospitals. And so this has been a feature of this conflict since the very first day. And the stories that we are hearing, as Mahan had shared in a past episode, that Sudan is a deeply conservative, predominantly Islamist society. And so the types of violations that we're reading, the types of the brutality that women, girls, children, families have endured, the fact that we are hearing these stories is truly alarming, because we know that in conservative societies where opportunities for marriage, where the honor of a family is tied very much to their girls, it's really difficult for these stories to come out. So the women who have spoken up, those who have given their stories, are to be so commended, because it's shining spotlight on what the suffering that is going on. But we know that statistically it's far more widespread than we're probably seeing, just because of the social stigma. And as Kataza has said, that, you know, the RSF, the UN has found that the violence of the RSF, or the Janjaweed, now call themselves the RSF, amounts to crimes against humanity. In the places where the SAF is in control, it's far more difficult for people to really get a better or proper, full understanding of what is happening there. But we have heard stories of women having to trade their bodies in order to access humanitarian aid that are controlled by soldiers, and so on and so forth. And a lot of this really comes back to the position that women held in the political transitions in Sudan. There's been a real, Sudanese women have been at the forefront of many of the movements, the political changes, the December Revolution. A lot of women and young people were on the streets calling for the bringing down of Bashir. Historically, Sudanese feminists have been organized. They have been systematic in their speaking up and calling for the rights for the defense of women. And so some have suggested that this is a kind of a specific backlash and boxing back these women who have stood up and who have wanted to shape the nation and to call for further protections and further rights for women to be protected in Sudan. But as Kataza has described, the consequences for these individual women, individual families, are devastating. We've also seen a reported a rise in marriages, so-called marriages, of young girls in order to protect them from sexual exploitation. At times, these have also been organized in marriages in RSF-controlled areas to RSF fighters, so that they can provide some protection for these girls. And these are also human rights violations, because these are girls often who are not over the age of maturity, who are not really consenting to this process, and are yet folded into the worsening scale of violations that have taken place in Sudan.
You know, as you were talking, Sarah, it made me think that in the case of a civil war, the normal channels, the infrastructure of justice is not functioning. And so it made me wonder how people do find ways of reporting, because I would imagine that the reports that we have are just a fraction of what's actually taking place. So could you speak to the pathways that are available to civilians living in this situation right now in Sudan, and also speak to the role that CSW has in terms of providing channels of reporting and documenting cases of rights violations?
When it comes to sort of conflict-related sexual violence, a lot of the reporting that's been documented and sort of accepted as part of the public record or international record has come through organizations such as Human Rights Watch and Amnesty and a number of Sudanese-based organizations. In part, the sort of the larger organizations have, because of their name, can protect people a little bit better. Much of their research is conducted through sources on the ground, through interviewing humanitarian workers, midwives, community workers who are supporting women and supporting families and girls. So that gives a picture of, for those who are able to seek some form of medical treatment, what is going on, and to be able to sort of capture an essence of what's happening on the ground. And as Kataz has already mentioned, you know, one of the things that's seriously lacking is not only physical care, medical care, but also psychosocial support and trauma processing and support for these women. So it's vitally important that these stories are documented. The UN have a fact-finding mission, and part of their role is to gather and to store evidence, so that there can be a time and a day where this evidence can be put forward before the International Criminal Court or any post-conflict tribunal that that will hopefully happen, and there can be a form of accountability. And so at the sort of very kind of high level, that is where this documentation is so important. People's stories matter, this evidence matters, and it's important that that is recorded, it's recognized, and that we can hope at some point soon there will be justice.
Well, I was just going to add, in terms of, on the documentation side, that Sudan's civil society have been really heroic in just gathering information. They've done this, you know, human rights defenders and others, they've done this under threat of death, really. I mean, some of them have been killed by the protagonists because they're exposing what is happening, and they're actually coming alongside some of these women and girls and men and boys to help. Another source of documentation is IDPs in neighboring countries. For example, those who have fled to Chad, where, you know, there are a lot of, they're sort of large numbers who have fled there, and they're telling, particularly the ones from Darfur, are telling the tales of the brutality that they've faced, which also includes the massacre of men, and then they themselves, the women, being subjected to horrific gang rape and all sorts of other things. So it's the information is coming out, and as Sarah said, these stories matter, and they have to be documented so that there's accountability eventually.
Is beyond the fact-finding mission, where, I guess, what avenues are there for taking this documentation, the next steps to securing finally justice in these cases?
I think domestically, there are elements of the justice system that are operational. In parts that are controlled by the SAF in particular. But I think, as we know, in the contexts, perhaps in the UK or in the US, in sort of Western countries, other countries, securing justice through the courts for sexual and gender-based violence is very complicated, and it's quite difficult. In Sudan, you have the added challenge where the legal landscape criminalizes sex outside of marriage. So often a victim or somebody who has survived sexual violence, in order for them to report that to the police, could at times find themselves then charged with adultery if they do not meet that standard. And so there has historically not been sort of the take up of criminal cases, but a lot of work has happened, particularly in places like Darfur, over decades, where committed lawyers working with humanitarian workers, doctors, etc., who painfully and faithfully document these violations and are able to work with victims and their families to present to court cases and to present this information in order to secure justice. But it's not a small thing to have recorded and to go through the legal process of some of the worst things that have happened to you. I think for any of us, I think we would recognize that is a difficult process. And for those who do, it's truly commendable, their bravery, their courage to continue to do so. But given the dynamics of the conflict at this point in time, recording that information being stored by the UN fact-finding mission, the African Commission also have a fact-finding mission, and documenting these violations so that one day there can be justice, there can be accountability. As we've seen in other regions around the world, in sort of post-conflict situations, the accountability is so important. It's so important for the women of Sudan, but it's also so important because we see this across the region. We pull together and work to collaborate with African women from Africa in the diaspora to call for the protection of women and girls in Sudan last September. And this rally call really comes from the fact that this conflict-related sexual violence, we're seeing this in conflict after conflict, and these perpetrators are emboldened because they do not see accountability. They do not see the justice mechanisms sort of being enforced. And so it's vitally important that we continue to document, but we continue to advocate for there to be accountability measures. And also for at the highest level, sort of the UN Human Rights Council we engage with, but also at the Security Council, that this becomes part of that kind of global protection mechanisms and structures.
And just to add to what Sarah has said, accountability will combat the impunity that surrounds this kind of violation, particularly CSRV, but also every human rights violation, atrocity crime. And there is also the opportunity, once a violation has been documented, to bring about accountability for those who leave the country in order to avoid accountability within the country. So there is a legal procedure called universal jurisdiction. Quite a few countries have adopted this, which means they can try a person in their country. For example, we're in the UK. We can try somebody who has arrived in the UK who has committed violations elsewhere, as long as there's enough documentation information about this person. And to an extent, something like that is happening or has happened. There was a man who was from the safety of the UK as he was driving taxis, actually dictating how women should be violated in Sudan. He was encouraging it, he was promoting it, and he was doing this over Twitter, X. We kind of worked, one of us worked with the government here to stop this man and to bring him to justice. So that kind of thing can also be done, as well as the sort of more high-level interventions and also the local interventions. If there's enough evidence against a person, and this person actually provided his own evidence with his videos, which were really, really quite disgusting, you can actually take action within the country where they find themselves.
Hearing you ladies share, I find myself in the midst of such a heavy conversation, feeling a glimmer of hope towards the accountability and the justice that can take place with good, solid documentation as the process moves forward. But I realize that in many, many of these cases, if justice comes, it's often so delayed and takes so long to come to fruition, which is a struggle. And it leaves me wondering about the now and how people cope with the trauma of what they've experienced. And I know that CSW does work in the area of psychosocial support. So can you ladies speak to the work that CSW does in those areas and how that we've been able to come alongside women and people who have experienced such degrees of trauma?
Yeah, sure. We have we've delivered some psychosocial support programs primarily to human rights defenders, to those who work with those whose human rights are being violated. And in the context of Sudan, I think many of those human rights defenders are also finding themselves experiencing human rights violations. And when it comes to conflict-related sort of sexual violence, we haven't specifically worked directly on this particular issue. But one person that I can think of that we trained happened to be in Chad and had traveled on another business to Chad and was in one of the refugee camps there, where there was significant numbers of Sudanese Darfuri had fled to. And in conversation with CSW, he was able to share some of his learnings and share some of the psychosocial support program that he'd learned. And one of the things that he reflected on, he said, you know, I was there to do something completely different. This person is a lawyer, so I was there doing slightly different work. But if I hadn't received this psychosocial support training, I wouldn't have been able to cope with my week there doing the work that I was there doing. And said that every single person I met was traumatized in one way, shape or form. Some were able to maybe express some of that, the difficulties, what they had been through, what they'd experienced. And some of them, you could just see it in their eyes. And so having received some of this training, and we really work with supporting journalists, lawyers, people who would be meeting with those and interviewing those who have gone through human rights violations, and just giving them some context and some understanding that somebody might not be able to talk about something, but you need to get information for a story or perhaps get information so that you can make a legal submission, and giving some sort of strategies around how to navigate that and how to help the person that's in front of them. That's some of the small ways in which we have CSW kind of contributed into this space, but there is so much more that is needed. We've spoken before about decisions that have been made in terms of aid cuts. These are some of the areas where there have been, there's been an impact on the cutting of humanitarian aid and support, resourcing organizations that can go into camps, IDP camps, resourcing often women who are doctors, nurses, midwives, people who are in the community who are able to sit with, to help women, girls, men, boys, those who've experienced conflict-related sexual violence, to process their trauma. And that processing is so important, not just for them personally, added to the accountability piece of seeing justice, but also, as we've shared quite a few times in this podcast, that, you know, we work towards the aim of there will be a day that Sudan will be at peace with itself. There will be a day where, you know, neighbors can live side by side peacefully. But what we often perhaps miss is that internal process, that one-to-one personal process of reconciling with what has happened, what has been lost, the wrong that's been done, and coming to the other side of that and processing that is really vitally important. And some of the psychosocial support programs are there to support people in that.
Yeah, the phrase secondary trauma comes to mind for workers, human rights workers that are working with people, medical field, whoever, that are working with people have experienced such trauma, to be one on the ground with them is a can be what's known as a form of secondary trauma for them to know how to process such difficult stories and experiences so they can better resource the people that they're working with. So it sounds like CSW has a role in that area as well. So that's encouraging.
Yeah, that's true. But we must also never forget that those people are also traumatized themselves, and sometimes they don't realize that they're busy helping human rights defenders, etc., are very busy helping others who are going through things. They may not have themselves suffered this exact violation, but they are in the whole dysfunctional situation where violations are occurring. And they have to recognize their own trauma and address it before they can be of, you know, full assistance to others. And I think that's one of the most important parts of the psychosocial training, that people who didn't realize that some of the things they're going through and some of the symptoms that they're feeling and some of the, you know, expressions that they're sort of like showing to the world are actually due to the fact that they themselves are traumatized because they look to the people they're helping and don't remember that they're also in the same, you know, dangerous situation and have also been, you know, suffered some degree of violation.
That's the end of part one of our conversation with Dr. Kataza Gonwe about women in Sudan. We'll be back next week to finish off the conversation with part two. See you then. Thank you for listening to the CSW Free to Believe podcast. CSW is a Christian human rights organization advocating for freedom of religion or belief. As Christians, we stand with everyone facing injustice because of their religion or belief. Our work, including this podcast, exists because of the generosity of our supporters just like you. If you're interested in finding out more or making a donation, go to csw.org.uk. You can help us grow this work and help it become a resource, highlighting and amplifying the voices of those who suffer as a result of their religion or belief by sharing it with your friends or by leaving a 5-star review in whichever podcast catcher you're currently listening to. The CSW Free to Believe Spotlight Series is hosted by Darren Adolpoker and Kiri Kankwende. It's produced by Sam Jackson Reed, and our theme music is by Sizgi, thanks to Artlist.io.